21 today, 21 today. Aww. It's episode 21, 21 today. Yay!
Happy birthday to Dove.
We need to wait another month or so before we can sing that one about our podcast.
Oh, my Lord. Sorry, I just got very excited there.
Well, it's episode 21. It's worth being excited.
Yes, episode 21. We rock. Yay, thank you, everyone, who has supported us in getting this far.
Okay. We did all this in episode 20. I don't think we need to do it again.
Oh, okay. Simples. I like the meerkats. For those people overseas, we have a whole heap of ads here in Australia. Do they have the meerkats here?
Yeah, they have them in the UK, yes.
Okay.
I don't really want to talk about ads. We have a big show tonight. We need to get on with it.
Okay. Yes. Sorry. Yes. Go.
What the... Hello and welcome to the What the History podcast, your fortnightly bits of bizarre history that will make you say, what the history?
Nom noms.
I am Trevor Holland.
And I'm Susie Holland. Hello.
And what wonderful bit of what the history do you have for us this evening?
I've got a musical kind of story here. Ooh. Bear with me, everyone. Bear with me. It is pretty cool. Yeah, well, I think it is anyway. Okay, now this is about Pink Floyd. Yay! I know people out there love Pink Floyd like I do. Yay! Okay, now, being one of the most progressive bands of the entire history of the universe, Pink Floyd not only tore down walls with their music. Yeah, see what I did there? And who can forget the day the Berlin Wall came down? Okay, for those who are younger, go check it out on YouTube, okay? And the following Pink Floyd concert, The Wall Live in Berlin, go and check that out as well. That came out in 1990 to celebrate the wall coming down on the 9th of November 1989. I remember being so happy that a wall that divided the families and friends of people in Germany was finally torn down. I was so excited. And then Pink Floyd said they were going to do a concert celebrating the fall of communist rule, and I just got, yay, more excited about that too. But this isn't a story about the Berlin Wall coming down. No, it is not. But it is about Pink Floyd. Now, this particular Pink Floyd concert ended another kind of rule, and that rule was of an entire council in Venice in 1989. The third weekend in July 1989 in Venice was set to celebrate the Feast of the Redeemer, known as the Redentor. Sorry for my Italian, I don't even want to try and pronounce that properly, which celebrates the end of a terrible plague that occurred in 1578. Pink Floyd was set to do their final concert of their Momentary Lapse of Reason tour in Venice and loved the idea of performing there. In the past, Venetians moved into the St. Mark's Basin area, which takes in St. Mark's Square and the Basilica, to watch fireworks from their boats, and in the 18th century it was common to see musicians entertaining from their gondolas, and it was this past scene that Pink Floyd's Italian promoter, Francesco Tomasi, wanted to recreate, and this free concert was going to do just that. Except the size of the event meant that the individual boats idea was scrapped. Instead, Tomasi thought of using a stage, and this stage idea was to include a floating barge stage, 318 feet long by 79 feet wide and 79 feet high.
Wow.
So it is massive. You should check out the photos of it. This thing is huge. Not everyone was keen on this idea, funny enough, with some city officials peeved that someone would dare stage a rock music concert the same time as the Redentor. And 1 month before the concert, there was a fierce debate, and that was in quotes, where it went to a democratic vote, and the concert was voted to go ahead. But it was voted against by the mayor of Venice, Antonio Casalatti. The go-ahead was given to Italy's state broadcaster, either RAI or RAI, I'm just going to go with RAI, to televise the show. It all looked like it was going to be a fantastic night. However, 3 days before the event, Venice's superintendent for cultural heritage, Margherita Asso, nicknamed the Iron Superintendent, that's a great nickname, vetoed the concert on the grounds that the ancient mosaics, statues and monuments in St. Mark's Square and the Basilica would be at significant risk of damage, and the piazza could sink under the weight of the concert goers. And now there was actually a reason for this. In 1960, a concert by the Rolling Stones did cause the piazza to sink lower into the marshy lagoons with the amount of people that were there. So Tomasi had to think on his feet. It's 3 days before one of the biggest bands in the world was going to take to a floating stage in a very historic city with the eyes of the world on Venice. Augusto Salvadori, a former Venice tourism commissioner, quipped to the New York Times, and I quote, "Historic centres should not be used for performances that are incompatible with their historic nature. If they want rock, let them do it in a football stadium, but not in the Piazza San Marco." End quote. RAI had already sold the broadcast rights to more than 12 countries, so what to do? Simples! Meerkats! I had to, they're so cute. So, the stage was now a floating barge that was set back another 98 feet from the concertgoers, and the sound was arranged to be turned down from 100 decibels to 60. That the concert was now going to be 182 metres from St Mark's Square, with suitable crowd fencing provided. Given at the time there was only 60,000 permanent residents of Venice, now get this, 200,000 concert goers spilled into Venice that night, much to the chagrin of residents and officials who were against the idea of the concert. That's a lot of people. So let's recap here. 200,000 people rocking out to Pink Floyd in a small space in a concert that was televised in over 20 countries with an estimated worldwide audience of almost 100 million people. 90 minutes later, it was all over, but what happened afterwards was a bit of the what the. It was the audience and planners of the concert that created the what the, and there were reportedly weren't many toilets. So you could just imagine what's going to happen. People went to the toilet wherever they could, and they did their business on walls and monuments and dumped their rubbish everywhere all over the historic square. 300 tons of rubbish and 500 cubic meters of cans and bottles were collected over the following few days. The only monument which was damaged was the Judgment of Solomon, which had some marble removed, but it was enough for the naysayers of the concert to sit back and say, "I told you so." These same naysayers were also extremely outraged and turned it into a major scandal that further split council traditionalists and the council progressives, and at the public meeting 2 days later, the Venetian residents had had enough and called for the entire council resignation, howling down the mayor who had opposed the concert from the beginning, and he called it a mistake and claimed his government had come under, and I quote, "unusual pressure from RAI and other political interest groups," end quote, and advised that there were many contacts and contracts in this whole affair, to which the residents howled down, yelling out, I love this, "no excuses, fools and scoundrels, resign, resign, you have turned Venice into a toilet." No, they were quite vehement about this. Mm. Yep. Venetian Deputy Premier Gianni De Michelis of the Socialist Party, a party which pushed for the concert to go ahead, told residents and concerned officials, and again I quote, "let's not declare a holy war. After all, nothing particularly serious happened in relation to the large mass of people," end quote. And another Venetian, Vittorio Sgarbi, scoffing at the opposing crowd, calling them complaining Cassandras. And Venice was always a city for spectacles. This is ridiculous. There wasn't even a death. A little trash and all will be forgotten in 3 days. Still, the calls came for resignation of the Venetian Council, and the environmental group Italia Nostra, or Our Italy, filed a formal complaint with the Venetian magistrate alleging misconduct and corruption within the council for allowing the concert to go ahead. By the end of the week, the entire council had resigned, including the mayor, who never wanted the concert in the first place. Ah, yes. Footage shows the amount of people, not only at the square, but out in the canal itself in various craft, and it looked like a lot of fun. And go and check out the YouTube footage, especially the footage of the final song of the concert, which was Run Like Hell. Yay! Love that song. I was rocking out to it this afternoon. It was awesome.
Mind you, I'd certainly go out of my way to get to a free Pink Floyd concert.
Hell yeah! Yes, I'm doing
indeed.
It.
Indeed. Wow. A bit of...
I'm doing it.
government shenanigans, hey?
Yes, with Pink Floyd.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, I think concerns with government decisions, I mean, that pretty much goes back a fair way, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it would at least go back to 1925.
I see what you did there.
Segway king,
I am.
I
love your Segway king. You are. All hail the Segway king. Yeah. All hail.
I'm sure there's listeners out there that might disagree with that.
Oh.
Anyway.
All right, boom.
There have been many important decisions made in courtrooms. Decisions that have changed laws, fought corruption, and impacted the lives of many. Then there's a trial that changed very little at the time, whilst also being a tourism boon to the town where it occurred. Let me set up this piece of legal what the history for you. In January 1925, in the US state of Tennessee, there was a member of the House of Representatives named John Washington Butler. Being a bit of a fundamentalist, he was of the school of thought that felt science was no good if it was going to condemn souls to eternal damnation.
Oh, no.
With this belief behind him, he introduced a bill which would make it illegal for teachers working in state finance school, no matter how little the state paid, to, and I quote, teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals.
Ooh.
End quote. I can only imagine a won't somebody think of the children got added to the debate at some point. Anyone daring to break this law would be fined between $100 and $500 per offence. Many government correspondents at the time were stunned by the introduction of the bill, even more so when it got through on a vote of 71-5. Once it got to the Senate, many thought it would be stopped there, with one senator valiantly attempting to derail it by trying to add an amendment to prohibit teaching that the world was round. He failed. Look, even there, it got through 24-6, with the final say and hope of many of the objectors going to Governor Austin Pay. Pay was a very progressive politician, and it was widely believed he would veto the bill. He didn't. But only because he had made deals with more conservative politicians in an effort to get other education reform through. Governor Pay was not overly worried, saying as the bill was signed into the law, quote, probably the law will never be applied, end quote. Fast forward to April 1925, and the American Civil Liberties Union, UCLA for short, decided the law was not only unreasonable, it was also unconstitutional. They were particularly worried other states would follow Tennessee's example, and offered legal and financial assistance to anyone who would be willing to be charged under the law. Enter John Scopes, a newly appointed 24-year-old general science teacher and football coach at Rhea County Central High School in the town of Dayton, Tennessee. He was a firm supporter of Darwin's theory of evolution, who stated, quote, I don't see how a teacher can teach biology without teaching evolution, end quote. Especially since the state-approved textbooks included lessons on evolution at the time. At first, he was reluctant to take on the system, even with the support of the ACLU. It was only at the persuasion of friends and neighbours who pointed out the publicity of a trial would create interest in the town and would be great for local businesses that Scope finally agreed. He was subsequently arrested for breaking the new law on May 7, 1925. Within a week, word had spread and the challenge had been accepted. The World Christian Fundamentals Association invited William Jennings Bryan to act as prosecutor in the case. Bryan eagerly agreed. He was a well-known figure who had run unsuccessfully for president, was the Secretary of State during Woodrow Wilson's tenure as president, and was of the firm opinion that religious ethics were far more important than science. He once stated, quote, oh boy, it is better to trust in the rock of ages than to know the ages of rock. It is better for one to know that he is close to the Heavenly Father than to know how far the stars in the heavens are apart. End quote. William's involvement also guaranteed the impending trial would get a lot of attention from the media. It turned what would have been a hokey backwoods story into a matter of national interest. The ACLU were a little more reluctant about the defender who stepped forward to fight the charge. Charles Darrow was known to be very passionate in the courtroom, and was still in the public eye after getting two teenagers who had kidnapped and murdered a younger neighbour He got them life imprisonment instead of the death penalty. The main concern, though, was his controversial stance that Christianity was a slave religion. And according to his biographer, Kevin Turney, quote, he believed that religion was a sanctifier of bigotry, of narrowness, of ignorance, and the status quo, end quote. The ACLU featured Charles's involvement would turn any trial into a complete media circus, and only accepted the offer once Darrow stated that he would provide his services free of charge, quote, for the first, the last, and the only time in my life, end quote. So, on July 10, the Scopes trial, also known as the Scopes monkey trial, began. And at this point, it is hard to know if I should focus on the courtroom proceedings or what was happening in the town of Dayton. Let's discuss the latter first. Media and spectators rushed to the town, and the locals were ready. The streets were lined with vendors selling everything from fruit and sandwiches through to religious tracts and books on biology. Evangelists set up open-air sermons and covered nearby buildings with posters telling people to read their Bibles. Others were taking a more novel approach, largely involving monkeys. Monkey toys and other novelties were everywhere. The local soda fountain advertised a drink called the Monkey Fizz. The local butcher put out a sign saying, "We handle all kinds of meat, except monkey." And I have seen images online of a sign saying, "Darwin is right, inside," with a hand pointing towards a building, but unfortunately I cannot find out what it was referring to. And I looked. An exhibit opened featuring two chimpanzees and the missing link. One of the chimps, called Joe Mendy, entertained locals and visitors by monkeying around, as it were, on the courthouse lawn, dressed in a plaid suit, white shoes, and a brown fedora. The missing link was circus sideshow performer Joe Vaines, who was short, had a receding hairline, and a protruding jaw. Meanwhile, inside the courtroom, the scene was no less strange. The judge, John Ralston, insisted on starting each day's proceeding with an opening prayer, despite the defense's strong objection, as I felt it could prejudice the jury. The jurors were mostly church-going farmers. The judge immediately put a dent in the defense's case by ruling any scientific testimony regarding evolution as inadmissible, reasoning that Scopes was on trial and not the law that he broke. Even a challenge based on a section of the Tennessee Constitution, which stated, no preference shall be given by law to any religious establishment or mode of worship, was overturned by Judge Ralston. The fact that the defense had 12 expert witnesses, which included scientists and clergymen, to point out that the law was unreasonable and unrepresentative, the judge's decision to focus only on the fact that Scopes broke a law meant that all their testimony was deemed inadmissible, though Judge Ralston did allow them to submit affidavits. The media and other observers considered this last decision meant the trial was over and Scopes would be found guilty. But Darrow had one more idea and arranged to call the prosecutor, Brian, to the stand. The judge was worried the interest this move would create could overcrowd the courtroom and make the entire courthouse unstable, so he arranged for the trial to continue on the lawn of the courthouse. So it was, on July 21st, that Darrow began to cross-examine Brian. Asked if he believed that Jonah was swallowed by a whale, or that Adam and Eve were the first humans, or that all language came from the Tower of Babel, Brian responded by stating he accepted the Bible absolutely. Darrow turned merciless, forcing Brian to admit some examples in the Bible had to be taken figuratively, and making him contradict himself. What had started as an almost humorous, good-natured exchange started to turn into anger and insults and fist-shaking, until Brian finally tried to bring it to an end. The following was their exchange. Brian: Your Honour, I think I can shorten this testimony. The only purpose Mr. Darrow has is to slur at the Bible, but I will answer his questions, and I have no objection in the world. I want the world to know that this man, who does not believe in God, is trying to use a court in Tennessee. Darrow: I object to that. Brian: To slur at it, and while it will require time, I am willing to take it. Then Darrow responded with, I object to your statement. I am examining you on your fool ideas that no intelligent Christian on earth believes.
Ooh, burn!
Them there's fighting words. In response to this fairly humiliating experience, Brian hoped to put Darrow on the stand, but the Attorney General of Tennessee declared that the cross-examination was to be struck from the record, which blocked Brian's attempt. Darrow took the opportunity to ask that the judge find Scopes guilty, which would mean the case could be appealed. The judge agreed, asking that the jury find the defendant guilty, which they did, and had the consequence of denying Brian his closing statement. Scopes was ordered to pay a $100 fine. Brian never got a chance to respond to his public humiliation. He died in his sleep a mere 5 days later on July 26. Now, the appeal did not go to plan. The decision was overturned by the Tennessee Supreme Court, but on the technicality that the judge should not have instructed the jury to return a guilty verdict. Though it was never actively enforced, the law remained in place until 1968, when the U.S. Supreme Court declared a similar law in Arkansas unconstitutional. Despite the loss, Scopes was offered an extension to his teaching contract, as long as he obeyed the law. A group of scientists instead arranged a scholarship for him, allowing him to attend the University of Chicago. So, pretty good ending for him.
Yeah, it was.
The aftermath of the trial had quite the impact. A play based on the trial, called Inherit the Wind, I don't know why, became a Broadway hit. A number of songs, including The John Scopes Trial, Can't Make a Monkey Out of Me, Brian's Last Fight, and Monkey Business, were inspired by the trial. The town of Dayton even has an annual Scopes Trial Festival, so everyone can remember and enjoy the what the history of the event.
Oh, well done, Trev. Whew. Well done.
That one was a doozy.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yes.
This is a little bit longer than usual.
We are running a bit longer with this one, but these two stories, I think, they had to be told. They're amazing.
Amazing, and yeah. And of course, I've just got visuals on yours. That's hilarious.
Oh, just there's actually newsreel footage of reports of the Scopes trial. So that's something which I've actually will link to in the references down below. And of course, if you want to find out more about what we've talked about, there are references just down below that you can click through and find out more.
And some of my references have got the YouTube footage that I was referring to earlier. And yeah, go check it out. It's really interesting.
Yeah, so much fun. And of course, if you want to know more, if you want to check out our back episodes, you can certainly do that. You can head to our homepage, wthpod.rufusproject.com. And while you're there, you can even leave a comment on your favorite episodes or what you think of what we've done. If you do want to get in touch, that was awkward, you can also find the What the History podcast page on Facebook. We're on Twitter @pod_what, or you can even search up #WTHpod, which should point you through to most of our stuff. If you are nice and old-fashioned, you can even send us one of them their emails.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. To WTHpod@rufusproject.com. We would love to hear from you.
Dear, you're taking me back to the 20th century there. I'm not sure I want to go back there.
I know. Nice.
You're sending me back to Squaresville.
Oh, man. Okay, now we've devolved a Simpsons quote. On a longer episode, I think we need to wrap this up pretty quickly. So until next time, in a couple of weeks' time, we shall be back with two more bits of bizarre history to make you say, What the history?
Good night, everyone.
Bye.
It was no surprise how she could tantalize. Monkey business, nothing else to do. Just sit and polyvoo like monkeys in the zoo. This baby sure did know her stuff. I said, I'm through, you play too rough, there's nothing.